once you retired or once you transitioned?
Well, you know, that wasn't so much of you know, thinking about our succession. What it was, after 30 years of being a senior pastor, having lots of staff underneath me and a lot of conflict, and there was, you know, we had longevity. We had four pastors, 10 years and 13 years. We had longevity, but we had some short ones too. And so I knew everything that could have gone wrong with an associate staff, and because I'd experienced it. So I basically, every one of those things I wrote in that covenant's got a name on it. And so from that, I learned I would never want that to happen to somebody that was over me. So I sort of took every scenario that I thought could be, you know, an out and be undermining the leadership, and I wrote that.
And Jeremy, helpful?
Yeah, helpful, and also, you know, actually kind of took the process for me to really learn how great it was that Raleigh even would do that, because it wasn't something that I was strategically thinking was needed or anything like that. But as I walked through the process and heard horror stories from other people and from other situations, it kind of dawned on me that, you know, this doesn't always happen, you know, where a leader is really got the integrity that a person like Raleigh has to treat the church as though it's Christ's church and really mean that, and to hand it to the next generation the way he did.
All right. So others of you on the panel here, any comments or reactions or responses you'd like to make?
I appreciate the model. The idea that that my succession might be able to happen as smooth as yours is good to use. I like the idea of having it spelled out so that myself and those around me can rest in the fact that there is a pathway to make this happen, and the idea that it isn't your church.
Just the mic just closer.
Clip it closer. That you saw that it isn't your church, it's Christ's church, and you're willing to die to self to make it happen and to give him the glory. So, great model. I'm glad it's here, and I'll be using it.
Tom or Bill?
Jeremy knows this, and Raleigh, too, that we have an affinity group of pastors who pastor churches of 1,000 or more. Raleigh was part of that for many years. Jeremy's now joined it. And this has been a discussion over the last few years because, as Raleigh knows, that group is aging. And Jeremy, at the last March's meeting, spelled this out, and I think there was silence in the room that it could happen so well. And what I see here is intentionality, and thinking ahead of what could go wrong. Raleigh, knowing that while he loves the church, he's also human. And he could give in to the human temptations, but he wants to have accountability. And so often in these kinds of situations, when there isn't intentionality and accountability, you set yourself up for disaster. Without that, I can tell you horror story after horror story across the country, but I just want to give the example of my predecessor, Paul Cedar. And while we didn't spend a lot of time talking about succession, because when he left, there was no intention that I would be his successor, either on my part or his part. It wasn't planned. Paul Cedar has given me one of the greatest gifts that a predecessor could give, and that is he has always spoken well of me. And I've heard back through the rumor mill the nice things he said, and I have not once in 17 years heard a criticism from Paul Cedar that came back to me. That is fantastic, and that's a gift that all of us should give to the one who succeeds us. And I'm sure that's exactly what Raleigh does, but it's not an easy job.
I make a comment in the paper that it seems to me that in some ways the formality with which they did it may in part be because of the complexity of a large church, but I guarantee you that even in the a middle and smaller sized church, the pastor who retires and stays in the community because they own the home, that's what's different than 25 years ago. Longevity of pastorates, so you have much deeper, long established relationships, and spouses with careers, spouses with jobs. All of those contribute to this. We don't necessarily leave the community, and that's in any size church, any size town. And again, whether it's the more formal looking approach that Raleigh and Jeremy have taken, or just good, clear thinking about this, if you're going to go that route, would be very valuable. Okay.
Can I just add, you know, what that is our executive limitations. Basically, that says what I won't do. And I fortunately haven't had to, you know, face that. I've not been pushed up against that. But I just want to take 1 minute. I wrote some things down which make it work. First of all, mutually, we respect one another. I respect Jeremy's shepherding ability as a pastor. That's a high value for me, his teaching and his theology. We esteem one another privately and publicly. That really helps me, and I hope it helps him. And then for me, it's really good for me to have a seat at the table. I'm an influencer. I'm not the decider. But it does feel good to be a part of a church and to have your experience to still be an influencer. I take the mentor role. I'm not a coach. I don't kick his butt, tell him what to do. I wait for him to ask me. So, you know, that's a real distinction. And I have many other mentor roles, so I've had some practice there. I take a parenting perspective. It's like I celebrate Jeremy's success, not like, you know, I'm the parent, he's the child, but, you know, parents don't compete with their children. So when Jeremy succeeds, I don't feel competitive. I feel like a parent. I go, all right, man, that's cool. I mean, he knocked it out of the park on Sunday, and that was just so cool. And then I'm challenged. I'm challenged, though, in some areas. You know, I'm challenged to trust the Holy Spirit to guide him and not me. And just recently, last Monday night, we had some really heated discussions theologically. I get an email from him, all the elders do, and the Holy Spirit had worked in Jeremy's heart, and you know, he came back and apologized for some things, and I go, that's the Holy Spirit's job, man. You know, that was just awesome. I'm not defensive when his strengths expose my weaknesses. And that happens because, you know, you go 30 years and you think you're perfect, although you know you're not. But then when you see that God's doing some things in less than 2 years that you couldn't do in 30 years, you know, I'm not defensive. And I'm not prideful when Jeremy's weaknesses expose my strengths. And then I'm not hurt when he increases and my influence decreases. And that's kind of hard. Just a quick ending story. About a couple of months ago, I preached 20, 25%. And so I preached that Sunday, and at the coffee shop the next week, one of our longtime members said, yeah, a guy came up to me after the service, and he said, who's that new guy up there? And he said, well, you know, he laughed. He said, well, he's just been here 30 years. So, you know, but at least it wasn't a bad report.
Great. Thank you for sharing. The next, and actually the most frequent of all of these, is simply, you're pastoring one church, and now you sense God's called you to pastor another church, and you go to that other one, and lo and behold, the church you were serving calls a new person. So now you've got the former pastor and the new pastor scenario has emerged. And Tom Macy had a very interesting experience because he was both sides of that with the same person. You can read the story in the white paper, but Tom, tell us about honoring the former and being honored by the former.
Unlike Raleigh, 32 years and continuing, I've been a pastor for 35 years, but I'm in my fourth place of ministry. I guess as a foundation for this, I became very aware 1976, 1977, when I went to the little town of Sumner, Nebraska, population 250. I became aware very early that there were pastors who had been there before me, and I could pretty much tell you as I went back through my predecessors, Harold Frederickson, Arlie Abrams, Harry Swanson, Marlon Jones, Earl Gunsolly, that's taken some of you way back, that they were much loved, but I could also tell who in the church particularly liked this pastor and who liked that pastor. And I realized that, wow, this is an interesting chain of leadership that I'm following. And I have to be very, very careful guarding my own heart, but also just how I honor these men and don't grab a hold of the comments that people make about them, positively or negatively, in a way that that I'm intimidated or that in any way I accept at face value what's being said. So that's a little bit of the background. I served another church in Nebraska for 5 years, and then in 1985, I was called to First Free Wichita, Kansas. Mike Andrus, that many of you will know, was the pastor at First Free Wichita from 1975 to 1984 when he moved to St. Louis to plant a church there. I had known Mike. I'm from the Wichita area, so I had some history in the area. I'd gotten to know him, so we were friends, not extremely close, but friends. And but when I was called there, it was from my small town Nebraska experience. I'm a Kansas farm boy growing up. Pretty intimidating to follow Mike Andrus, a great expositor of the reputation that he had, but the Lord took us there. We were there for 18 years and then actually left there the last few months. They were pretty painful. It was a difficult separation. And then after being gone from there for just a few months, Mike was called back as the interim pastor. He's still there 7 years later. It's a pretty long interim. But the first thing Mike did when he was asked to consider being interim for a while was he called me and asked for my blessing. Now, that didn't just come out of nowhere. That came from a long history of our relationship that had grown and developed over 15 to 20 years. During the time that I was in Wichita, again, first feeling a bit of intimidation at following this man. But because of his reaching out to me, he actually shared a copy of the exit letter that he'd sent to the leadership after he left, just sharing some of his perspective, showed tremendous kindness and honor to me. I felt the freedom to invite him back on different occasions to preach, including the 50th anniversary and such times as that. I also learned how to beg Cardinals tickets from him when I wanted to go to a baseball game in St. Louis, and that was fun as well. But in 2004, early 2004, when Mike was called back as interim, we were friends, so it made it easier, I suppose. But he had honored me, and not that that was any reason either way that I shouldn't, but that certainly paved the way, just the relationship that we had for me to feel thrilled, in fact, that he was called back into what was a little bit of a volatile situation that was stabilized beautifully because of that. And this is where it turns in, for me, far more, even more beautiful as it goes along. I was out of the church for 6 months before I moved to Indianapolis. And the Sunday before my first Sunday in Indianapolis, Mike invited me to come back 6.5 months after I'd left First Free, invited me to preach again. That was powerfully healing for me, powerfully healing. A little tough on my wife, but that was just a marvelous experience. What Mike has modeled since he has now become my successor, after I was his successor, he has kept me informed. I get an email from him regularly telling me who's died, what's happened, what's going on in the church. I've been back 3 times to preach total, 1 weekend to perform the wedding of his son to the daughter of one of my very close friends, and then more recently, just this past September, I was invited back again. Next summer, there's the expectation that his successor will be installed, and I've already been invited to be a part of that. So even though I'm no longer the pastor at First Free and haven't been for 7.5 years now, the fact that we had such a significant time of our lives in the church, that's continued to be honored, and that has set a model for me that I want to always do that for those that follow that I forgot which direction it goes, but that I can provide that kind of encouragement for those that that are on either side of me in ministry. And I'm just so grateful for the partnership that Mike and I have had within the same congregation.
Right. Some of you want to respond on the panel here just to his story and what made it work or what you heard or questions you want to ask him.
Well, and I just think it's just the principle of esteeming, you know, other pastors and speaking well of them. I mean, it's pretty basic 101, and those both are really, you know, spiritually mature men, both Mike and Tom.
Tom, question I'd ask is, so how much do you think it was your relationship to each other that really carried the day, or was it the actual honoring of each other through coming back to speak and stuff like that? Or is it both?
I would say it's definitely both. I mean, I had tremendous admiration for him and high respect for him. But I also, and I think this goes back to my dad, the model that I had as a kid in terms of seeing pastors come and go, seeing the favorites, and my own father was great as a layman, as a deacon in the Baptist church, modeling, not you know, holding up one pastor above another. So that was a high value that I had. And but certainly my friendship and respect for Mike made it easy to you know, have him back. And I think it's made it easy for him to have me back. So that's been very, very special.
Yeah. Well, what my ears picked up was the congregation played a role in it as well. Your home church congregation taught you something over the years as you saw them not, or put it positively, respond positively to pastoral changes. Yeah, and so then began to try to practice that as well. And First Free of Wichita, in spite of some hard months, still managed to practice that. And in some ways, that transitions us well to the third topic, which is positive pastoral transitions are not just about two pastors being nice to each other and getting along with each other and knowing when and when not to invite them back to speak, but it's really a lot of times involves the health of the congregation as well. And this whole thing started with a district superintendent saying, I have a very troubled church because of a conflict within a church that seems to have centered on a former pastor that's still there. But that means the congregation contributed to it somehow. So I've asked one of the district superintendents, who was not the originator of the email, but was participating in some of the exchanges, and then our own president, too, to just speak about impact on congregations of pastoral transitions being done well.
Could have been the author, but I wasn't. A mess happens. Conflict happens. And it gives opportunity for temptation and opportunity for the spirit to show up and for character to be displayed. And how we bear ourselves during that time will bring glory for a long time or will bring difficulties for a long time that will last long after just that one event. This last year and a half has brought to me several situations that I thought would never come, and in a matter of weeks, a whole congregation is turned upside down. And what does affect that congregation as to how they endure that is how the pastor and how the leaders are able to handle that. Are they going to, do they have in mind, do they know when to hold them? Do they know when to fold them? Are they aware of the impact that that even the smallest decisions, the seemingly small conversations they have, the tide or the wake that leaves behind in the life of a congregation, and not only is it the pastor and the pastors that are involved in the church leaders, but their spouses, that are involved, the families that are impacted, the spouses of the elders and all the leaders and the staff people. It is just, it's horrendous seeing the damage that can take place if character is being tested and we fail. And I think a lot of it comes to having conversations like this right now, determining right now among ourselves how it is that we want to abide by those times. When do we hold on to our rights? When do we deny ourselves? How long do we hold on and expect justice, and when do we give mercy, and all those things come into play and are challenged. And I think that's where, you know, thinking it through now, thinking it through with others, and depending upon your relationship with the superintendent or other pastors in the area, who can you go to help be the ballast to be able to help keep you balanced during that time? Because when you're in that time, though you think you're, I just came off a lot of drugs. I thought I was clear-minded for the last 2 weeks. Some will think I'm not clear-minded now, but it sure feels like I'm more clear-minded these last few days than I was the last 2 weeks. So it's best that we think through these principles right now, have others around that can help anchor us and to guide us through. And I appreciated the intentionality of just you with your leadership as a part of leadership development. You know, when the waters are calm, let's talk about how when they're not going to be calm and what's the pathway we can go through there. So all those kinds of issues, I think we can help set the table to be able to get through those times if we do it beforehand. I could go on and on, but that's enough for now, I think.
Do you want to comment, Nixon?
Having the privilege of being a district superintendent for 5 years and then serving in the national office for now 20 years. It is amazing to me how much destruction has taken place because the former pastor did not follow the same kind of positive intentionality that Tom and Raleigh have followed. The worst case scenarios are where there was a bad ending, a rough ending. You called it a rough ending. It was a tough ending. I know you well, Tom. But where there was a rough ending, or sometimes a really terrible ending, and the pastor stays in the community and ends up, because of his pride, feeling he was wrong, starting another church. And that damages the body. And the line I often use is, we have to recognize that it's Christ's bride that we're damaging, and we have to love the bride more than we love ourselves. And I think that's something you think about when you're not in pain and make that intentionality work if it happens to you, God forbid. The other cases that I've seen where there's great pain in the church is where, for one reason or another, as John said at the beginning, the pastor stays in the community. The former pastor does. Maybe it's because he's retired and he wants to stay with these people who have loved him for 30 years or 10 years or whatever it is. I understand how that can work, but it's hard work. I know some churches right now that are really in pain because the retired pastor stayed, and he withholds his blessing on what the present pastor and the elders are doing. Maybe he doesn't even say anything, but his lack of speaking up and support, his facial gestures in business meetings, where his friends for all those years are looking at him to see if it's okay, and he's trying not to get involved and trying not to make those statements, but he's doing it. Or maybe his wife is doing it. Those are tough. One of the things that are different in this day that from when I started out back in 72 is so many pastors now own their homes, and in this time of recession, they don't want to move. Or their spouse has just a tremendous job and they don't want to move. And so they're always there in that community, and sometimes they're there in the church. I know Glenn is dealing with a situation right now where the pastor is in the community and not in the church because it was a rough ending. It's caused a great deal of pain. But even beyond that, and this is what I experienced when I left my church after 14 years, was when you've been in a church for any number of years, you have people who are loyal to you, as Tom talked about earlier. And even though I had left the community, I'd went to Nebraska to be the district superintendent, I would get phone calls from people in the church asking me, essentially, they would nuance it a little better than this, is it okay that our new pastor is doing this? Is it all right that the elders are moving in this direction? And I had to kindly, graciously tell them, I'm not your pastor. And I support what your pastor and the elders are doing. I know those elders. I trust those elders. Please follow their leadership. But they were trying to get me to be on their side against what they didn't like. When I moved back to Minneapolis, and this is a decision that Karen and I had to make, and I think it would be similar to what a lot of us need to make, the pastor who succeeded me, who is a friend, took me out to lunch and asked me if we would come back to the church because we were so dearly loved. And I said, no, we won't. It's because we are so dearly loved and they trust us so much, I could see where it could be a hindrance for you, and I want you to have the freedom to pastor and be their pastor. He argued with me, but I think we made the right decision because I didn't want to have to deal with people continually coming to me and saying, what about this? What about that? What do you think about what the board's doing? What do you think about the pastor's doing? I wanted to be supportive of him in other ways. And so we went to another church where I think in some ways we would have been happier at our former church. But we thought, I felt it was best for that church and in some ways best for us not to. So I think you need to know yourself. But be very careful when you retire, especially, and you want to stay in your former church, be very, very careful and make sure your new pastor's your best friend, or at least he knows that he can trust you. Again, I give the example of Paul Cedar. I have complete trust in him because of the way he has acted honorably in this transition.
Let me just add that, and then we'll go to questions here. The picture isn't that it's always going to be bad, okay? But the picture is that it is often enough a problem that we ought to at least go into it knowingly, okay? So that's why we're bringing it out in the open. Arnie, you wanted to comment.
This is not going to be very organized, but just different responses. Some of you may not be aware that on a weekly basis, I deal with churches in transition, not only evangelical free churches, but Baptist churches and Christian Missionary Alliance churches and so on. This is not a free church issue or problem, folks. This covers a lot of these different denominations. Number one, as I reflect, and I'm 68 years old now, so pastored a long time in a lot of different situations. But from what I've seen, one primary component of the issue is the pastor's personality. If he is a type A, if he has a huge ego, and the next pastor is just not going to do things the way he did it, then you got a problem, okay? So we've got to deal with that. And I'll be very honest with you, I needed some real counsel when I was going through college and seminary, and I'm afraid some of the churches that I pastored did not get the best because I had issues that needed to be dealt with that were not dealt with at all. Unfortunately, my spiritual father, my brother Stan, was in Japan most of that time, and so I didn't have the mentoring that I needed. But I really think that we need to do something in the preparation of pastors to make them more team members than isolated performers, and I'm using the word performers positively. Number two that I would say is I think we're in a transition nationally with churches. I don't know if you've read the same material I have, but a fellow by the name of Donald Miller from California wrote a book entitled Rediscovering Protestantism, where he basically focused on the entire shift of, to use Barna's terminology, the king of the hill to a team leadership. And that's what a lot of churches are doing today. Many of our churches, free churches as well as other churches, are going to elder-led governments, and the pastor is a part of that team. And some of our pastors that were trained like me to be king of the hill are struggling with that new paradigm. And consequently, if you make that change, when I left, I'm still a member at Grace Free that I served for 18 years, and we have a great relationship just like you did, Tom, and do, Tom, and it works fine. One more minute. Oh, boy. Okay. So those are the different dynamics we're dealing with, not only here in the Free Church, but all around, and a lot of churches are going through that. The final point I would like to make is we have long had a record of Pastor A comes in, he leads the church for 10 years, leaves his mark, he leaves, Pastor B comes in, and a lot of times the church says, well, we had a weakness over here and we need to fill that, so then the pendulum swings over there, and this poor church of whatever size is going this way, then that way, then this way, then that way. And we have no continuity. That's why IPM, we're trying to develop the habit of doing, of picturing to the church a relay race. And we have our interims passing the baton on to new pastors to try to change that attitude and that atmosphere in a church.
All right. Someone else wish to comment?
I'm pastor at a church that is 32 years old. We've had a switch in the pastorate six times in 32 years. None of them were good. And unbeknownst to, you know, this year in January, my elders came to me and said, we want you to take sabbatical. And I said, great, it's been 8 years. I'm ready. At the same time, I was discussing with the elders this whole idea of strategic succession. And that kind of got out, and people were talking about it. And at the same time, we were remodeling the church. And before I went on my sabbatical, which started in June, I cleaned my office out in May so that they could go in there and remodel it. And without even thinking about it, all of a sudden I had all these people like, you're leaving. So when you talk about strategic succession, can you discuss maybe a little bit how we can, in a more sensitive manner, address that?
Well, in a congregational government, first of all, it probably will take a bylaw change. It depends upon, because most congregational governments, you have a search committee or your elders search committee. And so to make a smooth transition, you have to be able to trust your lead pastor, if he's a part of it, or trust your elders, because they then, our congregation, we had our bylaw changed, we had to work through the bylaw that gave them a chance, and I would say then, because then they had to turn over that to choose the person to be the successor, they had to give that authority, and I would say that, you know, to get the congregation through that, you have to even work through the whole thought process of it, and it will probably take a bylaw change. So it's just one thought. Plus, the book, The Elephant in the Boardroom, is excellent, and I would begin with the emergency transition. It's got to happen in any church anyways. You should plan ahead. And then a retirement succession, it should be already thought out, and then the succession of handing it off. Those are three different elements of it, and we did the first two.
Yeah, my name is Mark Frizz from St. Louis, Missouri. I wanted to thank Jeremy and Raleigh for the work they've done. Wow, I wish We had had all of our staff sign something like this when they came on. At my church in St. Louis, we went through a terrible period in 2010 where a visitation pastor who was 77 years old, we asked him to finally retire. And then we had another member of our staff, an associate pastor that we had work-related issues and theological issues with, that we tried to do something very gentle and sensitive, but, you know, it didn't work, and it created tremendous upheaval in the congregation. So two questions. First of all, what do you think about having all staff sign a covenant of alignment and staff unity when they come on board? And then secondly, the big argument this past year at our church was, well, we have to be authentic, and we have to tell everybody all the things about why. So we ended up, because this staff member wanted to make it known that he was quote-unquote fired, we ended up having to get up, have a meeting for the whole congregation, and tell them all the reasons why he was fired, which made it very difficult for him and for the congregation. So how do you deal with this thing, this new thing where we have to be so authentic about everything? And just, I was just curious as to your thoughts on that.
I'm going to make a leader rule. That's not really quite the topic today, because it's positive pastoral transitions, the former to the new pastor. But it is a significant enough question. What about preventing some of the having to have a former pastor, that we're going to just take, whoops, that question, and let you, I'm giving you time to think for a second, but I'm going to do it this way too. In 10 minutes, that whole area, wherever there's a table, has to be completely clean. So all of you who are sitting there have to leave with your laptops and with your books and everything. Not now, but in 10 minutes, it's got to be that way. So I'm going to let them answer, then we're going to have a little closing comment, and then I'm especially asking that group to skedaddle. Okay? Thank you.
Well, I'm just going to respond to the upheaval of when you have to let a staff go and be transparent. That's what began the tragedy. We lost a life through that process. And right after that, the K Club began in Chicago in 2000. And when you have a staff falling, or you have an immorality or a character issue or whatever, your bylaws are the key. And, you know, because our bylaws, the congregation hired the associate, and therefore they had to fire the associate, therefore they have to have the right to know why they should let him go. That will set you up for destruction in any large church, multiple staff. You, and the K Club discusses that often, and we could have that conversation, but it's your bylaws, and you, that will be a train wreck every time, and lives will be destroyed. We had a life taken, and it's very emotional for me.
The staff covenant idea, I think, is an excellent idea. When you have an existing staff, you work it through together. You don't impose it. And then as new individuals join your staff, you ask them as a condition of employment to sign on to it. But you start with what the group that you have and develop a covenant. There are covenants out there. They don't need to be detailed, but it's somewhat like what Raleigh and Jeremy have together. And then you and the elders are backing you up on it.
Love to have more questions, but we've run out of time. The conversation was just to be launched here. We are going to do a ministerial forum on the topic, and we'll invite interaction there, and I will be bringing this up in various settings where I try to get out to, and the district superintendents among us. This may be an interesting conversation for you to generate within your district, or for that matter, most of you pastors are in some kind of a cluster. Bring the question up. Take the white paper with you and just say, hey, this happened there, and talk about it with each other, and we'll see where that goes. It may pop up again at the National Leadership Conference.
The one issue that's in the paper that we did not bring up here is the more detailed and touchy issue of these invites back to do weddings and funerals, not to publicly speak or preach, because that's still quite controlled. But it's a significant issue. It's mentioned in the paper. We chose not to try to take it up here. This wasn't quite the right setting. But it consistently comes up as a former pastor is delighted to be asked to do it. But in some ways, it cheats the new pastor of the opportunity to build those same relationships that causes you as the former pastor to be asked to come back and do them. And so it's a touchy area. It's one we want to get out in the open and talk more about. Thank you for your participation. And before we have much else happen, would this group back here please start to exit as rapidly as you can? And at 6 o'clock, we will begin serving our banquet and or our evening meal together, and we will be eating back there. Thank you so much for the afternoon.